children. Power to the people.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of Tar Sands Dirty Oil and the Future of a Continent with author Andrew Nikiforuk. Proceeds will benefit KBOO Community Radio. This presentation will explore the dangers and destructiveness of tar sand oil production, a signature of peak oil. The event is sponsored by Alliance for Democracy and the Economic Justice Action Group of the First Unitarian Church. That's Tar Sands with author Andrew Nikiforuk, Tuesday, March 31st from 7 to 9 p.m. at First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland. More information is available by phone 503-232-5495.
The preceding silence has been brought to you by the people at KBOO who wish you would support us during our fundraising drives, as listeners provide nearly all of our annual funding. Visit kboo.fm anytime to make a donation. Thank you.
I'm Lena Alialoro.
This is Linda Olsenost.
This is Owen Bastable.
I'm Cicely Rogers.
I'm Lisa Lewis.
I'm Brian Pritchett.
This is Rebecca Nay.
I'm Robert Barncourt.
Volunteer run, community powered. This is the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon's protected wilderness grows by thousands of acres. The Dream Act is once again introduced into the Senate, and two children are taken from their home by police in an ongoing custody battle. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 27, 2009. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Crystal Leedy. No matter the weather, thousands of volunteers will head to the coast on Saturday for the Great Oregon Spring Cleanup. The event is one of two beach cleanups organized each year by Solve and the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. Oregon's first beach cleanup was in 1984. Last year, showers dampened the weekend along much of the coast, but that didn't stop more than 35,000 volunteers from picking up over 110,000 pounds of trash. Organizers expect just as many people to be on the beaches Saturday, despite predictions of light rain.
Federal stimulus money will help increase Oregon families' food stamp benefits by 13%. The State Department of Human Services says the increase will start April 1st. The increase will be added automatically to recipients' cards. A family receiving the average amount of $176 a month will see an increase to $200. Last month, one in seven Oregonians used federally funded food stamps.
After months of wrangling, on Wednesday, Congress voted to federally protect more than 200,000 acres of wilderness in Oregon. The Omnibus Public Lands Management Act passed by a healthy margin in the House, and Obama said he would sign it into law. The 10% of the land protected by the federal act is located in Oregon, covering areas near Mount Hood, the Gorge, Central and Southwest Oregon. Conservation groups have won a major struggle to preserve key parts of Oregon's wilderness, although only 4% of the state's land is federally protected.
In December, KBOO News reported on the case of Stephanie Johnston, a mother in Beaverton who has raised her three biological siblings after the children were abused and neglected by their biological parents in Virginia. Johnston was granted custody of the three children over 2 years ago and has, by all accounts, worked hard to give them a stable, safe, and loving environment. 2 months ago, just before Christmas, law enforcement officers came with child welfare agents to the Johnstons' home to take two of the three children to foster care in Virginia. They didn't have a signed court order and did not take the children at that time, but last week the child welfare agents and an armed Beaverton police officer showed up at the school of Tavi, age 9, and took her, kicking and screaming, into custody. The police then surrounded Johnston's home and took Connor, age 12, without allowing him even to put on his shoes. Jenka Soderberg has more.
Stephanie Johnston has had custody of her three younger siblings for the last 2 years. She retrieved her siblings from a troubled home in Virginia, from which she herself sought emancipation as a teenager. Stephanie Johnston.
I started off as the primary care provider for Wes and Connor when I was very young myself.
I left as a young teenager on my own, got emancipated. I've worked ever since then to hold a very responsible, respectful life. Never went through that turbulent teen period. I never got the opportunity. Always held a consistent employment, consistent housing, and my goal this whole time was to be the type of resource that the children would need when the time came. There's been a history of drug abuse, alcohol abuse, and domestic violence, both physical, also including emotional and mental abuse in our family for many, many, many years. Several years ago, it came to my understanding that the children were removed from our biological parents, my biological mother and her husband, who's the biological father of the children, and were in foster care in the state of Virginia. At that time, I began immediately in the process of preparing to have the children come live with me, including flying to Virginia to pick them up. At that time, the children were released from foster care with the understanding that they would come to me.
The Chief of Services for Chesapeake Social Services in Virginia, Vicki Harrelson, says the state is following federal law.
The responsibility is first for any children that come into custody of agencies is to work to reunify the children with the parents, okay? Unless the parents are unable or not able to improve over a period of time, then you would not be able to rule them out as potentially being able to care for their children again.
Although the children's biological mother has given up custody of the children, their father has apparently not given up custody. He was recently released from jail and has been allowed visitation rights by the state of Virginia. So, according to the Department of Human Services, the children had to be taken back to Virginia and put in separate foster homes to allow their biological father visitation rights. Both Tavi and Connor have written impassioned pleas to stay with their sister Stephanie, who they consider their mother. No information has been given as to why two of the three children have been taken, while their older brother Wes has been allowed to stay. Stephanie Johnston says that she was never shown a court order when the children were taken last Wednesday, but that Beaverton police helped Virginia child welfare workers to forcibly remove the two children. According to Detective Yazzolino of the Beaverton Police Department, the police never touched the children.
What we are is simply a presence to help kind of keep things calm. Generally speaking, people will remain calm. It's not a situation that if it were to get out of control, if it were not out of control, but a situation where if the person were to say, I'm not going to give you my child or I'm not going to transfer this information over or child to you or whatever, without direct court order with police, it's not something that we're going to get involved in. And that was not a court order in this specific situation from Virginia.
But friends of the family assert that Tavi, age 9, has bruises that prove that statement wrong, that police were involved and helped in physically removing her, kicking and screaming, from her school. According to Stephanie Johnston, the agencies involved have not been forthcoming with information as to why this is happening and what she can do to get the kids back.
We really haven't been given a sound reason, and that's part of our frustration. All the information that we've got back has been a lot of, you should have been informed by so-and-so, you should take this up with so-and-so, but we haven't been given very clear information.
Her Oregon caseworker appealed to the state of Virginia to let the kids stay in Oregon, but said that, quote, her hands were tied when it came to preventing their removal. For KABU News, I'm Jenka Soderberg reporting. Four animal rights activists in Santa Cruz, California, were arrested recently and charged with, quote, animal enterprise terrorism. Their crime amounted to nothing more than writing with chalk on sidewalks in support of animal liberation. Will Potter is the founder of the website greenisthenewred.com. He is in Portland this weekend to speak on the issue of so-called animal enterprise terrorism.
Regardless of how you feel about a lot of these tactics being used, what the government is trying to do is crack down on First Amendment activity and having a chilling effect on mainstream activist groups. So with the California example, there have been some very extreme actions going on that have been attributed to animal rights activists, even though they haven't claimed responsibility, such as leaving an incendiary device at a researcher's home. But the arrests that were made recently of four activists under this terrorism law were not for that. They were not accused of that. They're not tied to that. They are arrested, and in their indictment, their so-called crimes are listed as chalking defamatory slogans on public sidewalks, distributing leaflets that have personal information about researchers, including their phone numbers and addresses, and having protests where they've worn bandanas covering their faces. So, and in the press, they're being linked to the bombing and to very extreme activities. But in the courtroom, they have no evidence against them of anything related to that.
That was Will Potter of GreenIsTheNewRed.com. He will be speaking at the Red and Black Cafe in Portland tomorrow at 6 p.m.
Today, California's top finance officials announced a state budget plan that would increase income taxes and cut health care services for low-income residents. All California residents will face a 0.25% income tax surcharge. That should put $1.8 billion towards the state's impending $40 billion deficit. The biggest burden will be on low-income residents, who will see $1 billion in service cuts. That will include the elimination of dental coverage and decreased cash assistance for welfare recipients, the elderly, and the disabled. Critics of the budget plan say the finance and treasury officials are underestimating the amount of expected federal stimulus money that would cover these services. The Service Employees International Union and Health Access are among the groups lobbying for a reconsideration of the budget proposal before the service cuts take effect in July.
In the human cost of occupation in Iraq, 4,261 U.S. soldiers have died. Multiple studies have estimated that over 1 million Iraqis have been killed since the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003. The exact number of civilians killed is unknown, since neither the U.S. nor Iraqi governments do body counts of civilian casualties in the conflict. In the latest news from Iraq, Turkish troops have pulled out of Kurdish-controlled regions of northern Iraq, ending an offensive against alleged Kurdish PKK rebels. Yesterday, a car bomb killed 20 people in northern Baghdad in the third major attack in the capital this month. And in Texas, two Iraq war veterans are protesting a local bid by the military contractor KBR to build a road in their rural county. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. Tomorrow's weather calls for a high of 52 and a low of 40, with a 20% chance of rain.
Three years after Hurricane Katrina, a new study shows that stress-related heart attacks have increased dramatically in the years following the storm. Doctors at Tulane University Hospital and Clinic in New Orleans have treated three times as many heart attacks since the August 2005 hurricane. Although the study doesn't directly prove the link between Katrina and increased heart attacks, other doctors in the area believe the hurricane continues to affect people's stress levels. Other factors may play a part in the increase in heart attacks, including more smoking, alcohol abuse, and less exercise due to long-term stress. The study is one of the first to show such serious long-term health effects after a major catastrophe.
Two New England states are considering bills to legalize same-sex marriage. The New Hampshire House of Representatives approved a gay marriage bill yesterday. It now faces a vote in the Senate, and the state's governor opposes it. New Hampshire currently has a civil union law. In neighboring Vermont, the state Senate has passed a bill to legalize gay marriage, but it still must pass the House. Vermont's governor has said he will veto the bill if it reaches him. Vermont was the first state to legalize civil unions. Massachusetts and Connecticut are the only states where same-sex marriage is legal.
75 nations gathered at the United Nations last week to celebrate the Cluster Munitions Convention and call on nations to ratify the treaty. So far, 96 nations have signed the Cluster Bomb Treaty. It prohibits the use, production, stockpiling, and transfer of cluster bombs and requires clearance of affected areas, assistance to victims, and destruction of stockpiles. On March 11th, President Obama signed into law a provision stating that the United States can only export cluster munitions that leave behind less than 1% of their submunitions as duds. The main producers of cluster munitions, Russia, China, and the United States, have not signed the treaty. Yesterday, congressmen in Washington reintroduced a bill to clear obstacles faced by undocumented immigrant youth in the United States. The DREAM Act would help students who meet certain criteria. Students would have to prove that they arrived in the U.S. before age 15 and have been here for at least 5 years. They would have to be between 12 and 30 years old, have an American high school or GED, and demonstrate good moral character. If they meet these requirements, they would get temporary residency for 6 years and have to spend two of those years either in college or in the military to be eligible for permanent citizenship. KBOO's Maggie Starr spoke with Eric Sorensen about the DREAM Act. He's the communications director with CAUSA, a grassroots immigrant rights coalition in Oregon.
Thank you very much for joining us today, Eric.
Thank you for having me.
What obstacles do undocumented youth in Oregon face today when they graduate from high school?
Well, one of the problems is when youth are brought here as children by undocumented parents, they go to school. They're in the U.S. school system, or in this case would be in Oregon's public school system. And when they graduate, they are basically without papers. They're undocumented. And so that means in Oregon they can't go to school, to college. They can't apply for scholarships, all that stuff. There's kids here, and it's really not their fault, the situation that they're in. They were brought here as children, and they basically don't have any other way to go but go back to where they were brought from. And I mean, they didn't grow up there. A lot of them don't even know the language. It would be like us going down to another country, to south of the border, to try to get a job. So what happens is they aren't able to partake in the American dream, and they are basically pretty much either have to go home or they try to survive in the current system. But that is kind of the current state of affairs here in Oregon.
And what would the DREAM Act, which has just been reintroduced in the United States Congress, what would it do to address those problems?
Well, the DREAM Act would restore Oregon's right to determine residency requirements for in-state tuition and establish a path to legal status and eventual citizenship for undocumented youth. This would address the significant barriers to the success of the hardworking immigrant students who were brought here in this country as a very young age, and their desire to fully contribute to American society, they would be able to do that. We were really happy that it was introduced. It's a bipartisan bill. There's a lot of support for it. You know, this bill would actually strengthen the economy. And the reality is these youth are here, they're getting educated in the American-style education system. A lot of them, would allow them those who have good grades to be able to apply for scholarships and so forth. And what it is, in this global economy, we depend on an educated and skilled population. That's the DREAM Act would add thousands of talented, motivated, and multilingual and multicultural people to our workforce. And, you know, we need that right now in this country.
And what is your organization doing, and what are people in Oregon doing to support this bill?
Currently, we're allied with our national partners, and that's FIRM, Fair Immigration Reform Movement, also with National Council of La Raza and others. And what we've done, we've sent out action alerts to our members. We will continue to lobby our congressional delegation here in Oregon, and we haven't heard anything from them yet, whether they support. We assume that they probably do, but, you know, we're encouraging folks to contact their legislators about this.
All right. Well, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
That was Maggie Starr speaking with Eric Sorensen of CAUSA, Oregon's Grassroots Immigrant Rights Coalition.
Hours after the deadly attack in northwest Pakistan, President Obama announced what he is calling a new U.S. strategy for Afghanistan and Pakistan. But critics say the plan is more of the same. More troops in Afghanistan, more promises of aid, and more hopes of accountability. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
President Obama called for 4,000 more troops to be sent to Afghanistan. That's in addition to another 17,000 already planned for the region.
So I want the American people to understand that we have a clear and focused goal to disrupt, dismantle, and defeat Al-Qaeda in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and to prevent their return to either country in the future.
Obama said the troops will be used to train Afghan security forces. The president will also substantially increase the number of civilians on the ground to help build the country's infrastructure. Obama is also calling for $1.5 billion over the next 5 years for Pakistan to help build roads, hospitals, and schools. But this combination of aid and troops could be problematic, according to some. Former member of the House Armed Services Committee and director of the Win Without War Coalition, Tom Andrews.
Well, there's a kind of a contradiction here in the sense that the president announced at the very outset that this is going to be a very focused policy, that its mission was going after Al-Qaeda and its allies, not nation building. But at the same time, the president announced that he was going to call for greater accountability and a more responsive and stronger, you know, Afghan government. So it's the question is, well, which is it really?
Andrew said the call for a stable Afghanistan could mean a longer engagement in the area. Some Afghans also question the new president's strategy. Fatima Nazari is a member of Afghanistan's parliament. She spoke to FSRN through an interpreter.
We've heard so many talks. Now, if it's something that actually practiced, then we can see that the result. If it's just something that can be said, but we don't see it in practice, then it wouldn't make any difference.
Nazari also says the U.S. needs to engage with local people.
If the United States wants to be a major power, a major role-playing power in Afghanistan, if they want to continue to work in Afghanistan, the most important thing is that they need to be in touch with the people of Afghanistan, and they try to consider their views and the culture, but also their laws. They have a very good understanding, or a good understanding of the people of Afghanistan, and ask for their view.
President Obama did propose more engagement with local leaders across Afghanistan to promote a reconciliation process. He also said keeping the Taliban away is paramount.
For the Afghan people, the return to Taliban rule would condemn their country to brutal governance, international isolation, a paralyzed economy, and the denial of basic human rights to the Afghan people, especially women and girls.
Human rights groups are saying the U.S. must make the status of women in Afghanistan a central focus of the effort. Chair of the Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission, Dr. Seema Samar, says health care and education are vital.
Without security, we cannot have development. Without development, we cannot have security. But we cannot have both without respect for women's rights and women's participation.
The Obama plan did not include an exit strategy. Karen Miller, FSRN, Washington.
In one of the most violent attacks in months, a suicide bomber in Pakistan's northwest tribal areas blew up a packed mosque as people gathered for Friday prayers. An estimated 80 people are dead, with dozens injured. Former KABU volunteer and interim news director Catherine Comp reads for Gabe Matthews, who's reporting in the region for FSRN.
The blast happened at a mosque about 15 miles from Peshawar in Khyber Agency near the Afghanistan border. Hundreds of people were inside during Friday prayers when the suicide bomber detonated the weapon, bringing down the roof of the two-story building. Chaos ensued, with bloody survivors pulled from the rubble and transported to a hospital in Peshawar, as there's a lack of health facilities in this semi-autonomous tribal area. Ahmad Khan is 16. He lives in a nearby village. His relatives came to the mosque to pray. They were killed.
My relatives died in the blast. I hear they are all under debris.
Wait. Gonna do landing. It was Visarangira bus. Wait. Tormash for among our crew. Wait, gonna.
I do not know who will dig them out. They are all dead. My family is destroyed. Oh God, I am destroyed. My whole family is destroyed.
Why?
Ahmad Khan sits some 60 feet away from the destroyed mosque. He told FSRN he didn't have the courage to see the dead bodies of his relatives. Around 300 worshippers, including those going to Afghanistan, local people, paramilitary troops, and local security forces were inside. The mosque is adjacent to a Pakistan military checkpost, while there are barracks of paramilitary forces on the other side of the road. Most people avoid rushing to the injured due to the fear of a second blast. It is routine that a blast is followed by another. Gul Khan is among the seriously injured. He's a school-aged boy, and his right hand is cut off. There's just some skin connecting it to his body. He says he's worried for his hand. Blood is rushing out of it.
I know my hand's been cut off from my body. That's what I heard the man say when he brought me to the hospital. I can move my fingers, but I can't raise my hand. I'm afraid I'm going to lose it. I don't feel any pain in my hand, which isn't good.
Nobody has accepted responsibility for the suicide attack. But a member of the local Kasadar force, speaking on condition of anonymity, told FSRN he thinks it might be Taliban revenge.
Some months back, paramilitary troops killed some Taliban when they were passing through this checkpost. The next day, they announced an order to leave all checkposts, but we did not leave. Now I'm worried for my life.
Violence and attacks are on the rise in the tribal areas of Pakistan, but for the past several months, no groups have claimed responsibility for any of the attacks. Reading for Gabe Matthews in Peshawar, Pakistan, I'm Catherine Kamp, FSRN.
For the second day in a row, crowds in Bangkok from the United Front of Democracy Against Dictatorship, or UDD, have crowded the capital grounds in Thailand. This is part of a continuing political conflict between rural voters who backed the former prime minister and urban pro-business supporters of the current prime minister. FSRN's Claudia Cragg has the story.
Known locally as the Red Shirts, 20,000 pro-Thaksin United Front of Democracy protesters marched in Bangkok today calling for a new national election. They cried, "Abhisit, get out," referring to current Thai Prime Minister Abhisit Vejjajiva. These latest protesters are politically diametrically opposed to those who held Thailand's main airport under siege late last year. UDD leaders accuse the current PM of being a pawn of the military. UDD supporters began their protest yesterday near the Grand Palace, blocking politicians from entering Government House. The government has deployed an estimated 10,000 police and soldiers, but demonstrators say they plan further protests at other key locations. Claudia Cragg, Free Speech Radio.
New York has repealed some of the nation's strictest drug laws. Its draconian sentencing laws had been around for 30 years before the state legislature repealed them today. FSRN's Renee Feltz has more.
Marking a profound shift in policy, New York state lawmakers said it's better to view drug addiction as a hazard to public health. Governor David Patterson.
What we're going to do now is where people are addicted and have committed crimes because of their addiction, we are going to shift our services from punishment to treatment.
Patterson announced legislation that gives judges discretion to send first and second time nonviolent drug offenders to treatment programs. The deal also scales back mandatory prison terms for low-level nonviolent drug offenders. Lawmakers joining Patterson said the move could cut costs from $500 million a year for incarceration to about $80 million for treatment. Advocates for stronger reform say fiscal considerations shouldn't drive reform of a failed policy. They continue to call for further sentencing reform. Renee Belch, FSRN, New York.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we are open to your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Maggie Starr, Graham Kettner, Kendall Archer, and Avery Welkins. Our engineer is Rebecca Ney. The KBOO Evening News and a public affairs director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on the KBOO website at kboo.fm. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. I'm Crystal Levy.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on More Talk Radio, Cecil Prescott leads a discussion about public education in Oregon and the economic crisis, with guests Rachel Langford and Mike Rosen of Stand for Children. At 9 on the Old Mole Variety Hour, Lori Mercier interviews Jorge Lizarraga about the racial and class politics of city planning in Portland, who gets to do the planning, and how are neighborhoods affected. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre and myself. At 10:15, the guest on If You Love This Planet is Jeff Cohen, media critic and commentator. He describes the media environment at the beginning of the current Iraq conflict and explains how independent journalists and bloggers have become major players in today's multimedia landscape. And at 11, Jenka Soderberg speaks with John Herson. He just returned from Gaza, where he participated in a convoy of trucks trying to bring humanitarian aid to the region. Now stay tuned for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses.
Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, disaster anniversaries are ready-made news hooks for media always in search of one. March sees 20 years since the Exxon Valdez spilled at least 11 million gallons and likely very much more of crude oil in Prince William Sound, Alaska. It's also been 30 years this month since this country's worst nuclear accident, the partial core meltdown at Pennsylvania Nuclear Plant 3 Mile Island. Both incidents were seen as watershed revelations of institutional failures and engendered activism and calls for reform. But corporate media's looks back and lessons learned don't always identify the right lessons, and rarely engage meaningfully the role of media in explaining what went wrong or how to keep it from going wrong again. We'll hear from activist and marine biologist Ricky Ott, author of Not One Drop, Betrayal and Courage in the Wake of the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill, on that story, and from Harvey Wasserman, longtime nuclear activist and co-author of the book Killing Our Own, The Disaster of America's Experience with Atomic Radiation. All that's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
Some in the media are shaking their heads at the populist fury directed at the failed insurance giant AIG over the company paying out $165 million bonuses, much of which went to the division that was largely responsible for the company's collapse and the subsequent taxpayer bailout keeping it afloat. Among the complaints is that the media themselves have given too much critical attention to these bonuses, helping to fuel this Main Street fire. Well, don't hurl that accusation at ABC's World News with Charles Gibson. On March 17th and 18th, Gibson and financial reporter Betsy Stark stressed that public outrage was a problem. As Gibson put it, quote, "As a lot of people pointed out today, there's a real danger in this because everybody in this country has a vested interest in AIG succeeding because we, the taxpayer, essentially own the company, right?" Close quote. Stark agreed. But their advice wasn't heeded, so the following night, Gibson and Stark were at it again, with Gibson warning that, quote, "We may be driving down the value of the company we own," close quote. Stark added that taxpayers could be cutting off their noses to spite their faces. It's hard to believe these reporters really buy this. If they do, then criticism of any publicly owned or controlled enterprise is problematic. And shareholders criticizing mismanagement at corporations, a common practice, that would be dangerous too. Now, what really seems to gall some establishment reporters is that there's so much anger directed at Wall Street. It's worth remembering that when Gibson moderated a Democratic debate last year, he challenged Barack Obama on his plan to raise the capital gains tax, repeating the cherished and debunked right-wing argument that lowering taxes on the wealthy increases government revenue. It's another reminder of where a reporter like Charles Gibson is coming from.
As the war in Afghanistan grinds on, and in fact escalates, some lamentable media trends continue as well. Take the lead of a March 23rd piece in the New York Times, which told of a special forces operation that killed five people. Afghans say the dead were civilians, which the Times explained was, quote, "resurrecting a sore point that has troubled the American-led war here," close quote. Well, there's a lot to unpack there. Anger over civilian deaths is not being resurrected since it never went away. And how exactly can a war be troubled by itself? A few days before, the Times had a story about drone attacks in Afghanistan and neighboring Pakistan under the unfortunate headline, "The Downside of Letting Robots Do the Bombing." The piece downplayed impact on civilians, but noted that, quote, "even when precise, the drone strikes often kill women and children in militant compounds," close quote. When that happens, the Times reported, quote, "local Pashtun customs of Badal obligate their survivors to seek revenge," close quote. Not for the first time, then, the paper treats the desire to avenge family members' murders as some peculiar exotic custom, never seeming to question whether such bizarre attitudes and their impact might be part of what's troubling, not the war, but its victims.
And finally, breaking news in the New York Times business section, it turns out some of the claims made about the wonderful impact of NAFTA were wrong. Yes, you heard it there, well, last, but there it was in the headline of a March 24th article, "NAFTA's Promise Unfulfilled." The article explained that, quote, "in some cases, NAFTA produced results that were exactly the opposite of what was promised," close quote. These included cases where, quote, "domestic industries were dismantled as multinationals imported parts from their own suppliers," close quote, and, quote, "local farmers were priced out of the market by food imported tariff-free. Many Mexican farmers simply abandoned their land and headed north," close quote. Of course, these impacts, while they may have been the opposite of what was promised by NAFTA cheerleaders, were in fact predicted by numerous economists, labor organizers, and activists who were critical of NAFTA. It's just that those people couldn't get a hearing in papers like the New York Times, which, for its part, was having reporters make statements like this from a front-page news story, mind you, quote, "free trade means growth, free trade means growth, free trade means growth. Just say it 50 more times and all doubts will melt away," close quote. Doubts you might want to hold on to include whether the Times can make a clear-eyed assessment of NAFTA even years later.
Thank you, Peter. You're listening to Counter Spin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The Exxon Valdez supertanker spilled millions and millions of gallons of crude oil into Prince William Sound, Alaska, in March of 1989, devastating not just landscape, but livelihoods, as well as numerous kinds of fish, birds, seals, and other species that have not recovered. From Exxon's initial declaration of the event as an act of God, it was clear the corporation would go big in its PR offensive, and years of legal delays and manipulation manipulations have borne that out. So what about journalists? Have they held industry claims up to the sort of scrutiny necessary to keep something like the Exxon Valdez from happening again? We're joined now by Ricky Ott. Ricky Ott has years now of activism on the impact of the Valdez disaster and is author most recently of Not One Drop, Betrayal and Courage in the Wake of the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Ricky Ott.
Thank you very much.
Well, anniversaries tend to be about the past and how far we've come. I guess I'd first like you to address to what degree the Exxon Valdez oil spill is a live story as opposed to something that happened 20 years ago.
We still do not have the herring back in Prince William Sound. Herring are a foundational species in Prince William Sound. They're the forage fish that whales, seals, sea lions, seabirds all rely on. Realistically, without herring, Prince William Sound cannot recover. So we are waiting for the herring to recover. And they collapsed in 1989 when the young of the year did not survive their oil bath. And 4 years later when those fish should have become adults, they weren't there. And that's when the population crashed. We also rely on herring for our economy. So there are still fishermen to this day, the herring fishermen, it's closed indefinitely. They are out of that line of work. We are still incurring long-term harm from something that happened 20 years ago now. So that's the sort of the environmental and economic side, but there's more. And this is kind of where it's in the interest of all Americans to really understand what happened. In our Supreme Court decision back in June of 2008, the Supreme Court decided to break the link between punishment and profit. The jury had decided that it would really take a link between punishment and profit to punish a corporation this big. $5 billion was 1 year's net profit in 1994. The Supreme Court decided no, punishment should instead be linked to damages. And as I've just explained, we were only compensated for short-term damages. But this set precedent now, this capping of punitive damages to a one-to-one ratio of punitive to compensatory, this makes every community in America vulnerable to corporate greed. And the most, let's stay with Exxon Valdez, if $5 billion had indeed been punishment, then Exxon should have been the first company to double hull its tanker fleet and make them safer rather than the last. And what we see now is Exxon, of the top 10 oil shippers, Exxon has more single-hull tankers afloat in the world's ocean than the other nine companies combined, all to earn its shareholders an extra penny a year on their stocks.
On that hulling note, I was interested in the New York Times editorial that kind of declared matter-of-factly that supertankers are now double-hulled because of the Valdez. They made it sound as though that policy flowed sort of naturally and immediately from the disaster, and that's not at all how it went. I mean, you've just indicated that the company that ought to have gone straight to double-hulling, Exxon, is lagging, and it's been a lot of activism that has made the other companies take the steps that they've had, hasn't it?
It's only been activism. Congress passed the Oil Pollution Act of 1990 that requires double-hull tankers by the year 2015. That essentially gave these big, powerful oil companies 25 years to try to weaken and reduce that standard, and try they have. And it's the only thing that has kept that standard. There were two things. One was citizen oversight, citizen activism, also required by the Oil Pollution Act of 1990. It pushed back each end run that the oil companies tried four times. And finally, the Prestige and the Erica oil spills in Spain and France sealed the deal when the international community just got outraged and demanded double-hull tankers by the year 2012. The fleet is largely shifting over, and again, it's an Exxon who's the most recalcitrant company of all.
So if the theme is lessons learned, I guess maybe the most important lessons have to do with activism. Well, let me ask you, you've watched media operate now in Alaska and nationally for decades now, and you describe a process that I've heard you call media capture. What do you mean by that? How does that work?
I was shocked to see how easily these big oil companies, in this case Exxon, could make its story the dominant story in the news. And this has actually driven me to write two books trying to correct 20 years of wrongheadedness by the media. The lies started on day one. I landed in Valdez, and within 12 hours of the grounding, I was down with the federal scientists, the NOAA people, and they were estimating the size of the spill based on, you know, computer modeling, and it was between 11, low-end estimate, million gallons, to 38 million gallons. Exxon captured the low-end number. When the press started asking, I was in the room watching. Who validated that? Who verified that? Exxon spokesperson Frank Iarossi kind of threw out that alcohol may have been involved, quote. And just like that, I watched the national media switch tracks like a railroad, mm-hmm. and it became 11 million gallons ever since that day. The reason that's important, and I knew it would be, was because penalties are based on spill volume.
Right.
And correction measures based on spill volume. So what do we have in Alaska right now? We are prepared to respond to an Exxon Valdez oil size oil spill, which means three times less than what really spilled.
Than what actually happened. Well, that 11 yep. million is what you're, or even 10.8 is what is on the record. That's what's being reported in the anniversary coverage. Well, in 1989, FAIR did a study of the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour, then as now considered among the most serious news programs. And between February and August of that year, they did seven segments on the Valdez spill, not one of which included an environmentalist. Debate on that show was illustrated by the then chairman of Exxon and the governor of Alaska, who sat down to have a cozy conversation in which the governor of Alaska said that the chairman of Exxon was being far too heavy on his own company. So we found that a kind of top-down bias in media, talking to just the corporate officials and government officials, really left out what were the key perspectives at the time.
And, you know, it's not just at the time. That's another mm-hmm. huge problem, is that these stories evolved. The killing did not stop in 1989. Well, where was the media to cover the 1992 Pink Salmon Run collapse, 1993 Pink Salmon Run collapse? I mean, we actually held a blockade of Valdez Narrows, held up oil tanker traffic. That brought in the media and attention, and it started the ecosystem studies, which took 10 years to complete, and now we know that oil is more toxic than we thought. And where is the news on this? This should be tied into the debates right now on global climate crisis. Do we need to get off oil? Not only for the sake of the planet, but also that this stuff is much more toxic than we thought in the 1970s when we passed the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. We're talking 1% of a child's lung capacity for every 1 year of their life just by breathing urban air that the federal government regulates is safe and is not. Bush administration standards are now being challenged by Obama, and this is the fine soot standard. This is polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, the fraction of oil that we now know causes long-term harm mm-hmm. in wildlife and in people.
Let me ask you, how then do we sanction corporations that commit acts of devastation like that of the Valdez?
Well, I would like to see us take a good look at what we've done with these big corporations. We have given them, through the Supreme Court, rights that were only intended for humans. We have created literally a monster in our midst. We have created a way to consolidate wealth and power and privilege that is destroying our ability to hold these companies accountable. So I am advocating coalescing this sort of unrest across the nation that we saw starting with WTO protest in Seattle into a citizen movement and to pass the 28th Amendment to the Constitution, stripping corporations of human rights. This gets to the heart of campaign abuse, the legal system abuse, lack of enforcement of our law officials, and actually strikes at the heart of globalization. And to find more about that, please have, and I invite folks to come to ultimatecivics.com, 21st Century Civil Rights Movement, Human Rights versus Corporate Rights.
All right, then. I'd like to thank you very much for joining us today. We've been speaking with author and activist Dr. Ricky Ott. Again, you can follow her work on these issues at the website ultimatecivics.com. Thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin, Ricky Ott.
You're welcome, Janine.
Well, from one environmental catastrophe to another, the 30th anniversary of the Three Mile Island meltdown in Pennsylvania offers an opportunity to look at the spin in the media at the time of the incident and the way history has been written or rewritten over the years. While media accounts seem to agree that the partial meltdown at the Pennsylvania site was a serious disaster, the lesson we're supposed to learn is that it could have been worse and that it shouldn't cloud our thinking about nuclear power some 30 years down the road. We're joined now by Harvey Wasserman. He's a longtime nuclear activist, journalist, and author of many books, the most recent being Solartopia, Our Green-Powered Earth, AD 2030. Harvey Wasserman, welcome to Counterspin.
Great to be with you.
Now, the legacy of the Three Mile Island disaster for much of the corporate media is that it was more of a PR disaster than anything else. On Earth Day 1997, the PBS show Frontline told us no one was injured or killed. The New York Times Magazine, 10 years later, told us the same thing and said we were confusing a Jane Fonda movie with reality. John Stossel at ABC, no surprise, told us a few years ago that the amount of radiation that people in the area were exposed to was meaningless. A March 22nd column in the Washington Post again explained no one died and the health consequences were insignificant. What do you make of all of that?
Utter nonsense. I mean, the fact is that nobody knows how much radiation escaped from Three Mile Island. And nobody knows where it went. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission has admitted in front of Congress that they don't know where it went. And we just had a study released yesterday at Three Mile Island saying that a nuclear engineer has looked at it 30 years later and believes that far more radiation, as much as 100 times more radiation, escaped than was originally believed. They have put out estimates, but they are meaningless. And there was one PR sort of a flyer that was put out by the utility company saying essentially that everybody in the area got the equivalent of a chest x-ray. Mm-hmm. Well, if that was true, that means that they x-rayed all the pregnant women in the area, and we have long since stopped x-raying pregnant women because a single x-ray can be catastrophic to a fetus or an embryo in utero. So I went into the Three Mile Island area the year after the accident, and I conducted dozens of interviews with local people, and it was the worst week of my life. People were complaining of cancers, leukemias, birth defects, rashes, hair loss, lesions, a metallic taste in their mouth, which we correlated to similar reports at nuclear bomb tests, and actually among the pilots who dropped the bomb on Hiroshima. There is absolutely no doubt that Three Mile Island killed people, and now, 30 years later, we still have 2,400 families who filed a class action lawsuit in the 1980s after the accident, demanding compensation, and they have yet to have their case heard.
Well, the reporting we see today tells us that Three Mile Island was a bad day for the power industry, and they've had a hard time recovering and so on. I wanted to ask you about the coverage at the time of the disaster. Thanks to YouTube, we can see Walter Cronkite's report on CBS Evening News, and he opened with these words, "The world has never known a day quite like today. It faced the considerable uncertainties and dangers of the worst nuclear power plant accident of the atomic age, and the horror tonight is that it could get much worse." Close quote. The conventional wisdom, I guess, now is that there was a panic back then. Do you recall the coverage being particularly alarmist?
Well, it was because it was accurate to be alarmed. I mean, the fact is there was a hydrogen bubble inside the nuclear reactor that could have exploded. Ironically, one of the things that may have saved the northeast of the United States from a massive radiation release is that when Three Mile Island Unit 2 was being built, people in the area fought it tooth and nail, and one of the things they demanded was that since Three Mile Island is directly in the flight path of the Harrisburg Airport, they demanded that the containment dome be reinforced. And so the containment dome at Three Mile Island Unit 2 was actually one of the strongest in the world, and that may, ironically enough, have prevented a crack in the containment that would have done everything that Walter Cronkite was warning about. I also should point out that, you know, there were demonstrations at nuclear plants in the years beginning in 1976 at Seabrook, New Hampshire. And had it not been for the mass demonstrations at Seabrook and other nuclear plants, including, by the way, Three Mile Island, people were opposed to that reactor, no one would have paid the slightest attention to this accident. No one would have known really what was going on. We had had a previous accident that was potentially much worse, at the Fermi 1 unit in Monroe, Michigan, in 1966. And the officials, the authorities were actually on the brink of trying to evacuate Detroit during that accident, but nobody heard about it. I was in Ann Arbor at the time, and I didn't read about the accident for 7 years. So the panic that was put out by the media in 1979 was actually very, very well founded, because it could have been an apocalyptic event.
We've heard this with other issues, and certainly with this one, that activism pushes the media to a place where they probably wouldn't have been. How quickly did the industry PR effort kind of take control of the story? Because the looks back seem to be dominated by this industry-friendly perspective.
Well, immediately, of course. They had all the money. But one of the great ironies also of media history is that the accident coincided with the release of the China Syndrome movie, mm-hmm. From Jane Fonda, Michael Douglas, and Jack Lemmon. And that movie certainly would not have been made had it not been for the demonstrations at Diablo Canyon in California and in Seabrook and so on. In fact, I was on the set of the China Syndrome and gave a little bit of advice here and there on the movie. So the joke was that all the anchors, including Walter Cronkite, were running to see the China Syndrome in the daytime so they could do their reports at night. But the battle for control of the story is really ongoing. I mean, the fact of the matter is that people were killed at Three Mile Island, and this is a lethal assertion for an industry that's trying to, you know, make its way back with a renaissance.
I want to ask you about that. We've talked about that so-called renaissance of nuclear power before on Counterspin. It seems every few years the industry mounts a campaign touting its own comeback. It seems that this would only work if people either forget Three Mile Island or accept the line that it either wasn't so bad or that something like that simply cannot happen again.
Well, I love it when they say Three Mile Island was a success story, because what they overlook is that the asset at Three Mile Island Unit 2 was assessed at $900 million. And within, you know, a matter of minutes, a $900 million asset was turned into a multi-billion dollar liability. If that's the kind of success we're looking at, then it's no accident that the country's in a recession or a depression after all these years. I mean, the reality is that the nuclear industry cannot get private financing. And one of the reasons is Three Mile Island. They also cannot get private insurance. Had TMI been much, much worse, and several trillion dollars worth of damage had been done, which could have been done, could also have been done on September 11th when the jets flew into the World Trade Center. If they had flown into nuclear plants instead, this country would be in permanent bankruptcy. And all that is covered by federal liability insurance, because after 50 years, the nuclear power industry cannot get private coverage. And that was the case at Three Mile Island.
What do you think people should be thinking about as this anniversary is marked by the media?
Well, we are at a breaking point now. I mean, people like to say we're at crossroads about just about everything. But the fact is that the renewable energy industry, the solartopian technologies of wind, solar, tidal, geothermal, increased efficiency have now really emerged as major powers in the marketplace. And aside from all the radioactive dangers, we have, and also, by the way, it's a major landmark now with the abandonment of the Yucca Mountain, proposed waste dump at Yucca Mountain. This is also a multi-decade project, and after 50 years, with the abandonment by the Department of Energy and Obama and Harry Reid of Nevada of this idea of taking high-level nuclear waste to Nevada, the nuclear industry has nothing. After a half century, there is no plan whatsoever to do anything with the high-level nuclear waste except to let it sit there. So with the failure of Yucca Mountain and this last-ditch attempt by the nuclear industry to get federal funding to build new reactors, we really are looking at, in a year or two, if we can stop them, there will be no future for nuclear power whatsoever. This is the last gasp of the nuclear industry, which is one of the reasons they're so desperate to deny the impact of TMI on the health impacts, on the health of the people in central Pennsylvania. But I got to tell you, I have been there. I've interviewed the people. It is not something you want to do. The health impacts were devastating, both on people and on animals. And the biggest lie in industrial history in the United States remains this idea that no one was killed there. And what we really need to do is have the 2,400 families who filed their class action suit in the 1980s finally get their day in court, and then we'll see what really happens.
We've been speaking with Harvey Wasserman, longtime nuclear activist, journalist, and author of many books, including Killing Our Own, The Disaster of America's Experience with Atomic Radiation. His most recent is Solartopia, Our Green-Powered Earth, AD 2030. He's also the editor of nukefree.org, which is one of the many places you can read his latest column, People Died at 3 Mile Island. Harvey Wasserman, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Hey, thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the National Media Watch Group, based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website, www.fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
KABU is proud to co-sponsor Al Andalus Ensemble's Baghdad and 21 Strings Concert and CD release, Saturday, March 28th at 7:30 p.m. The Baghdad performance is a musical memorial to all the people whose lives were lost or destroyed in the War on Terror. Al Andalus Ensemble is steeped in tradition, merging classical, jazz, and contemporary music with sounds from the Middle East, North Africa, and Spain. That's Al Andalus Ensemble's performance, 21 Strings, March 28th. At Reed College's Hall Auditorium. More information is available by email, music@andalus.com, that's andalus.com, or by phone, 503-230-2379. KABU is a proud co-sponsor of Tar Sands Dirty Oil and the Future of a Continent, with author Andrew Nikiforuk. Proceeds will benefit KABU Community Radio. This presentation will explore the dangers and destructiveness of tar sand oil production, a signature of peak oil. The event is sponsored by Alliance for Democracy and the Economic Justice Action Group of the First Unitarian Church. That's Tar Sands with author Andrew Nikiforuk, Tuesday, March 31st from 7 to 9 p.m. at First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland. More information is available by phone, 503-232-5495.
You are listening to Bread and Roses on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Monkey Presents, presenting the French rumba, salsa, and flamenco band The Gypsy Kings live in concert. That's Sunday, September 6th at McMiniman's Edgefield. Gypsy Kings tickets are on sale this Saturday, March 28th at all Ticketmaster outlets, the Crystal Ballroom box office, or Ticketmaster.com. More information at EdgefieldConcerts.com.
People on the street now, faces long and grim. Souls are feeling heavy and faith is growing thin. Fears are getting stronger, feel them on the rise. Hopelessness got some by the throat, you can see it in their eyes. I said, how come?
Hi, I'm Nico and this is Bread and Roses, feminist news and public affairs on KABU Radio. Tonight on Bread and Roses, I'll be exploring the challenges and triumphs of single parents, how they can overcome already challenging circumstances, coupled with a poor economy and a job market that continually demands more and more. Later, Gabby Ross will explore another population who always struggles, but is struggling even more during tighter economic times, exploring the rights and needs of homeless school children. Right now, though, I want to introduce you to Morgan Seiler and Claire Bean. They're the creators of an online social network called iHeartSingleParents.com, and they're also the creators of a new magazine, Single Parents, that just came out this year. I talked with them recently about how they strike a balance between a successful career and raising their child on their own. It's a conversation I want to have myself. As a single mom facing unemployment herself in just a few weeks, issues of workplace discrimination and balancing work and parenting are dear to my heart. Do you think single parents are discriminated against in the workplace?
Yes. I don't think it's a blatant thing or a conscious thing. It's just the expectations of a 9-to-5 job are not always conducive to a single parent lifestyle. Just because what happens when your child gets sick and there isn't a husband or a father to pick up them up from daycare? It's up to you. Just as an example, like I remember when I was considering going into advertising, and it's a very, you know, it's very cutthroat industry to be in. But what was really interesting is learning from the HR person, and I asked her, is there any single parent here that work here? And she looked at me straight in the face and said, no, there's not. And she said, this is a project-based industry, and so if you need to be here till midnight, you're expected to be here till midnight. Well, I was thinking in my head, well, that's never going to happen. You know, I'm not going to leave my kids stranded at daycare from 6 p.m. till midnight.
That was Morgan Seiler, co-creator of Single Parent Magazine and the mother of a 2-year-old boy. Her business partner, Claire Bean, is also the mother of a 2-year-old boy. She had this to say.
I mean, when I found out I was pregnant and obviously not married, and I did let my employer know, I actually was let go. There's no way I could have proven that that's why they let me go. They didn't give me a reason. But I just thought that was, you know, interesting timing. And so maybe that speaks to the whole discrimination thing.
So, Morgan, when you go to a job interview, is that something that you put out there right away, that you're a single parent?
I didn't. No. I don't put it out there, but if I'm interested, and then it comes down to talking about the details of, you know, expectations, and I definitely let them know. This isn't fair, but I think that people automatically assume that a single parent is going to have more issues in the workplace. And I think we're as professional as anyone else, is that we, you know, we're judged unfairly on that.
Everybody on a shoestring. Everybody in a hole. Everybody on an old dead plane, crossing their.
A longtime advocate for the rights of women in the workplace is Ellen Bravo. She's the author of Taking on the Big Boys, or Why Feminism is Good for Families, Business, and the Nation. I spoke with her about how single mothers, women, and all people can create better working conditions in their workplace and fight discrimination before, during, and after work.
Government man spent his politics.
Ellen Bravo, women have lost about $500,000 over their lifetime because of pay loss. Do you think this is because of pure pay iniquity, or is it because of job loss?
There's a lot of different ways we could look at it. The key thing is about power. It's about bargaining power, and particularly that women's jobs are undervalued. You know, if you think about what is it that determines pay, sometimes people say it's about supply and demand. Well, clearly it's not that there's an overabundance of child care providers, that they earn close to poverty wages. Sometimes people say it's about, you know, danger and risk. One of the hardest, most in jobs with the greatest rate of injuries is nurses' aides, and yet it's among the lowest paid. It all comes back to the issue of power, and also how we as a society have valued these jobs. And the problem is that the market reflects a continuing legacy of discrimination. It's a long story. I talk about it a lot in my book, Taking on the Big Boys, but the essence of it is this, that for a long time women were simply excluded from certain jobs, and then when they were needed during the Civil War to be secretaries, say, you know, they were brought in at half to two-thirds the price. Turns out they did just fine in those jobs. Employers hired more and more of them. The jobs became what we now call female-dominated jobs, and yet the discriminatory rate is what determined what became the market rate. So when the law changed and said you can't pay women and men differently for doing the same job for the same employer, most women and men no longer did the same jobs, and the jobs women do pay less. We also pay less for jobs that women do in the home for free when they do them in the marketplace. That's what we have to change. We have to change that fundamental issue. And there's a lot of other things that go with it. In an economy like this, when you know, in some ways, the layoff numbers show larger numbers for men than for women, and the media has interpreted that story to mean women advance during bad times. Well, of course, women aren't advancing. Their pay hasn't gotten better. Their hours are being cut. They may look like they're employed, but their hours are being cut. And lots of women are also losing their jobs. Women and families suffer also when men lose their jobs. This isn't a competition. Our goal for equality isn't for men to do badly. It's for women to do justly. And men obviously have a stake in that. They suffer, too, when women's pay is unequal. It doesn't go into their pockets. It just goes into the pockets of the ones I call the big boys, the powers that be. So we have a lot of work to do, but there are also some exciting developments. You know, there's a champion in the White House for some significant change. And the interesting thing is, of course, just like FDR, this champion didn't get there by accident. It's because of a large grassroots movement across the country. So, for example, there's hope that a new law will be passed that will make it easier for people to organize into unions, and this president supports that. But it's because there's been a huge movement building for that for a long time. There's a movement that's won changes in a number of states, including in Oregon. There's a movement to win a form of family leave insurance so that having a baby doesn't put you on welfare or, you know, destroy your savings. And this is really exciting. For the first time, there's this high level of activity in the states. It was a very broad and diverse kind of coalition. So you see labor unions and women's groups and progressive employers and school nurses and the Alzheimer's Association and foster parents and people who care about chronic illness, public health, people who care about poverty and child advocacy and aging, working together to change these standards so that, you know, when we say we value families, unfortunately family values ends at the workplace door for many people. We need things like a new standard of minimum number of paid sick days. We need to expand family leave to include lots more people who are left out right now because the definition of family is so narrow. It excludes same-sex partners, for example, or siblings. And because it's unpaid and it doesn't cover routine illness, et cetera. So we need these new standards, and we have a chance to really create a sea change and see some of this happen in the next few years. It will only happen, though, if we really stay organized at the grassroots. It's never enough just to have a champion in office. It always takes a movement to make that change happen. And, you know, the big boys are saying, oh, no, it's a recession. You can't do that now. Well, here's the truth. Number one, we need it more than ever. This is the worst time to lose a job because you have a sick child or because you have a new baby. But also, the same big boys oppose it in good times and as well as bad. They oppose any standard. They'll say, oh, we oppose it if it's just in our city or our state. But the truth is they oppose it everywhere. They oppose regulation. We in the United States of America are living with the results of 8 years of massive deregulation. It's a disaster. We can't do it anymore.
If you're a worker, how do you negotiate for better conditions when, you know, it could make you appear to be the whistleblower or someone who, you know, might be the next to be let go?
Well, here, you know, I've spent 22 years working at 9 to 5, National Association of Working Women, and one of the things we always said is the best way to get what you need for yourself is to work with others on behalf of everyone. This is, and the second thing we would say is you don't always win if you stand up for yourself, but you never win if you don't. Collective action is a much better way to go. It's hard to do those individual negotiations. Most employers aren't asking you to sit down and talk to them about it. And so what we need to do is build our power, and there's lots of ways to do that. A union is one. Working through an organization like 9 to 5 or, you know, Moms Rising or groups that connect people together and work both for public policy change and for change within a workplace. You know, that's what we need to do. And this, the great thing is, it doesn't. You don't need to start with 1,000 or 100. It can be 3 of you, 2 of you. And you start by asking yourselves, who else feels like we do? And you each bring in one more. and you start to build a group that says, what's the key thing that we could just change this one thing? What would make it better here? And then you start to see who else feels the same way and who might be an ally in management. Even if they aren't the power broker, they might tell you how to approach the person who is.
But is now a good time to make demands for equality, or is this going to pale in the face of this deep recession?
Yeah, no, I think it's exactly the time that we have to say, it was wonderful, actually, President Obama said this the other day about health care. He said, we didn't do it in good times, we didn't do it in peacetime, we always find some excuse, we have to do it, we can't not do it. And also when people say, well, how are you going to do all these education and energy and, you know, family leave and health care and the economy, he said, we have no choice. We don't get to work on just one thing at a time. So our goal is to have some clear priorities of things we think we can win and think about who our champions and our allies are in doing this and work together and become part of these coalitions that are coming together to demand this change.
What do you think a family-friendly workplace looks like?
There's a company in North Carolina called SAS. It's a software company. They have a 35-hour work week. Nobody works more than 45 hours. The gates close at 6, and no one takes work home because the CEO believes that people who are workers who are relaxed are more productive. They have numerous 4 on-site childcare centers. They have an on-site healthcare center. So can you imagine, instead of all the time you spend getting to the doctor and waiting at the doctor, you just get a call and says, we're ready, and it takes you 5 minutes to walk there.
You talk about women doing their homework and researching the good companies to work for. How does that work for women and men desperate to find any work right now?
It's a very good question, because, you know, in times when there's little choice, you take what you can get. The question isn't so much can you find the best place to work, but can you help make the place you work better? And one way to do that is to make all workplaces better by changing public policy. And that means, you know, working for the kind of changes I talked about, working with the kind of groups I talked about, electing people who will then champion those kinds of efforts. And working with other people wherever you are to form a union or come together in whatever way to improve your ability to have a say.
That was Ellen Bravo. She's the author of Taking on the Big Boys, or Why Feminism is Good for Families, Business, and the Nation. During our discussion, she talked about joining forces with another like-minded person to get things done, try out new ideas, and that's exactly what 2 single parents I recently talked to are doing. Morgan Seiler and Claire Bean just started Single Parent Magazine by their own dime. They're also the creators of the online social network iHeart Single Parents. I talked with them more about how teamwork has helped them succeed.
Well, we met in the summer of 2007, Morgan and I, and we both had toddler boys. We had a lot in common, and we were just talking about how we were frustrated when we found out we were pregnant that we couldn't find any resources online worth really looking at. It was just links or just nothing really very helpful or supportive or uplifting. So we were brainstorming, and we decided, well, maybe we should start our own website. And so that's what we did. We started a social network similar to a MySpace, only just focused on single parents and not necessarily dating, but it's just a place. We say it's an authentic online community for single parents by single parents. So male, female, just no matter how you became a single parent, you're welcome there. And it's just really a supportive place that was... It's something that was missing. It wasn't out there. Mm-hmm. It wasn't available. So
it's only been around for a year. How big has it gotten already?
Well, it's gotten pretty big. I mean, we have about 2,500 single parents from all over the world, but mostly in Portland. So we have a big Portland following. And we partner with Meetup, the Portland Single Parent Meetup, and we do activities together. Then we have the online, iHeartSingleParents.com is their online source for fun and support and everything.
I think both Claire and I, we felt it, the need for it personally, and so we get it when other people, through iHeart find what they're looking for in terms of a sense of community and a sense that they're not alone anymore.
Is there anything that's different about it versus like another parenting site?
I mean, it's all single parent focused, so single parents have different challenges than do just regular married couples with kids. So, you know, we also have the single element, that's dating and love, sex, romance, relationships, and just needing more support with being a solo parent.
I think a lot of times in parenting sites, their articles are written assuming that you have a husband there, or assuming that the dad is around. And so there's a lot of just passive judgment passed that a single parent feels when they're reading those articles. And so what's great about just getting the feedback from iHeart and just being a part of the discussions or reading the other people's blog posts is that this is speaking directly to you. When people get your life, and they get kind of the issues that you're dealing with.
Just on a personal level, as single parents, are you guys able to work the 9-to-5 schedule most people do?
It's funny you should ask that. For the first time, I'm working a 9-to-5 schedule. I just started yesterday. But I think one of the reasons why I'm able to do that is because I'm in a serious relationship now. And so I'm starting to have the help that that comes with a partner or a husband. So, like, for instance, today I dropped Luke off at daycare, and my fiancé picked him up. But I think it's very difficult for single parents to do it all, to work the 9-to-5 and to work out daycare, not alone just the logistics of it, but the cost of it, too, you know?
Yeah, I think it's harder to get ahead if you do just have a 9-to-5 job as a single parent. Just me, personally, I believe in the entrepreneurship, trying things out for yourself and really creating something that you love and you can make into a business. It's easier said than done, of course. But there might be, I don't know, I was talking with a colleague today about that. There might be more single parents who are business owners because you can have flexibility with your hours and, you know, maybe you can get ahead even a little bit more. So you can... Sometimes that's the solution for single parents, to be able to have more time with their kids and also make the income that they need if they can get a successful business up and running.
You know, I think part of it for me is that, you know, there's just been always the fear of, oh, what if, you know, I can't make it and, you know, I just need a steady paycheck kind mm-hmm. of thing. So mm-hmm. I think it's just hard for, at least for me, I've always worked the 9-to-5 job, and now mm-hmm. I'm starting to not do that. Mm-hmm. And it's always just been this fear factor. And I know now I can do it, but mm-hmm. it's like, you know, your confidence is so shaken, I think, sometimes yeah. when you're a single parent already from not having anyone validate you. And
mm-hmm. so it can be scary. It's kind of interesting because Morgan's in... going into a 9-to-5 thing. You're just coming out of a 9-to-5 thing, and I have been out of it for quite a while, so I know exactly how you're feeling mm-hmm. about being afraid of kind of, what do I do now? How do I get a regular income? And
let's talk a little bit more about using your passion, or taking your passion and creating a business. Like, how have you guys done that logistically? What did it take to, you know, I know that Single Parent Magazine is just getting started. You're probably still working on the revenue part yeah. of that. But how is it logistically all gotten together? I mean, what goes into it?
It's still kind of getting together. Well, we took what we thought was a good idea and passion and tried to put it into some sort of a business model. And it just trial and error. And sometimes you come up against walls and you have to figure out how to get around it. And we're still working on it. We're still working on the revenue part, but we're getting closer. And we're finally getting to the point where we have a good business plan, or almost there.
Yeah.
And then we can go out and take it and get some funding.
Mm-hmm.
So,
logistically, how we kind of made that happen was both Claire and I, for the past year, we hadn't been working 9-to-5 jobs, so we could commit the majority of our day to working on building social networks, building iHeart Single Parents, and working on the magazine. And to offset some of our costs and our bills, we were lucky to be able to contract ourselves out. Like, Claire is a graphic designer, so she was able to freelance, but I was a photographer, so.
And we were lucky because we live we lived with our parents. I still live with my dad right now. It's common. I think a lot of our single-parent members on iHeart are living with their parents, too. So I think it's becoming more common.
Do you think that's become even more common in the last 6 months with everything that's going on with the economy?
I would guess, yeah. I would. Although single parents are different in that they're tough. I mean, we do have only one income usually, so we kind of know how to look for the bargains, and it's always kind of an economic stress,
mm-hmm.
I mean, for a lot of us. So,
do you think you ever would have been able to do the things that you're doing without having that partnership?
Definitely not.
I think what's so great about a partnership is that you get confidence, someone to validate your ideas and to mm-hmm. brainstorm bigger ideas. Like, your horizon is so much grander mm-hmm. than it was on your own. And you feel confident to go out there and do it. You don't second guess and doubt yourself.
Yeah, and I think just to add to that, that's great. And also, if you have something that you really love doing, then you can build from that and just really put it out there. I know that whole law of attraction thing is kind of popular right now, but there's really something to it, I think. If you really want something badly and you put it out there and you just have faith that it's going to happen, it does. It comes to you. Barbara Winter wrote a book called Making a Living Without a Job, and it's awesome. It really helps you determine where your passions are and how can you make a living from that. And so just putting yourself out there and knowing what you want, I think you're on your way.
I want to thank Morgan Seiler, Claire Bean, and Ellen Bravo for taking the time out to talk with me on this topic today. You can find links to iHeart Single Parents, Single Parent Magazine, as well as Ellen Bravo's site at our site, kbubreadandroses.blogspot.com. Stay tuned. In just a moment, Gabby Ross is going to take on the issue of homeless children in schools.
Listening to Bread and Roses on KBOO 90.7 FM. My name is Gabby, and I'm pleased to have Molly Fry in the studio with me. Molly Fry is a clinical social worker who works in the Reynolds School District as a homeless liaison. And throughout the show, we will explain a little bit more what that means. But first of all, where is Reynolds exactly? What, geographically, what does Reynolds districts mean?
Geographically, Reynolds is sort of bordered by the Columbia River and 181st Southeast. And then further east, we run into the Gresham School District at about 202nd. So we take in from Portland, Fairview, Gresham, Troutdale, actually.
So East County.
East County, definitely.
And what does a homeless liaison do?
We have really varied jobs, varied duties. Mainly we're there to provide outreach and advocacy for kids who have barriers to getting into school. Mainly they don't have a permanent home.
And I believe having a homeless liaison is actually a federal requirement for each school district and each school.
Correct. That was set out during the, or in the 1987 original McKinney-Vento Homeless Education Act. Every school district, in order to get Title I funds, has to have a homeless liaison.
So McKinney-Vento is a term you probably will hear more often throughout the show. It's actually amazingly progressive federal law that stipulates the educational rights of homeless children and families. And one of those stipulations is to have a position in the school districts that addresses the needs of homeless children and families. One reason I wanted to do the show is because Fox News recently aired one of the most inflammatory pieces I've seen come out of Fox News. And it takes a lot to still get me mad for Fox News because I'm used to what they call news. But that particular piece claimed that homeless liaisons, people like you, lie about the number of homeless
course, all
children.
The time.
You lie because somehow you benefit from lying. And Fox News compared that to the people in the movie Slumdog Millionaire who break children's legs to get money out of them. So would you explain to me what is the definition, according to McKinney-Vento and the school system, what is the definition of being homeless and why is that definition what it is?
Well, the confusion in Fox News really played this up, and they had a lot of misinformation. The Department of Education considers homeless kids to be ones who do not have a permanent home. They do not have to be unsheltered in the street, like Fox News was implying. For HUD, Housing and Urban Development, you need to be unsheltered to be counted. So God forbid if we had 2 million homeless kids in the street. That would be horrendous.
So under McKinney-Vento, you're also considered homeless if, for example, you live in a place that's just not suitable, such as, you know, we talked a little bit before the show, it's a car or a tent or a trailer.
If you live in a place that's not suitable for human habitation, so for instance, we've had kids who were living in a campground, they were definitely homeless. We've had kids in motels, hotels. In transitional housing, those kids are homeless. They do not have a permanent home.
And the majority of kids who are homeless are actually not staying in shelters simply because there isn't a whole lot of shelter space available. They end up what we call doubling up with family members, which can create pretty crazy situations of way too many people in way too small living space and not having your own bed. And so these kids are counted as homeless.
Yes, so they're living with relatives, they're living with grandparents, they're living with friends of friends, they're living with anyone who'll take them in.
Who also can kick them out at a whim because of some
it's
conflict.
It's very insecure housing. Again, the word permanency comes into mind here.
So what, under McKinney-Vento, what are the rights these children and families have in terms of education?
They have the right to enroll in school. It doesn't matter if they don't have an address. If they can't go into school and produce like an electricity bill with their name and their address on it, that doesn't matter. If they're in a homeless situation, then they have the right to enroll in that school of their choosing without barriers. So they don't need to produce things like documentation that we require of people, like vaccinations. They don't need to do that right away. The whole purpose of this law is to get kids into school as fast as possible. And our job is to get them into school within 24 hours of when they first present, when they first come in and say, I want to go to this school.
And what happens if I'm a kid and I'm going to a certain school in, let's say, Gresham, but then my family becomes homeless and I end up in a shelter in, let's say, downtown Portland?
Well, then the law provides that the school district or school you were going to when you became homeless is the one that you can continue to go to.
And if you choose and want to.
If you choose. then it's up to the school district to make that happen in terms of providing transportation, free and reduced lunch, clothing, things that help kids stay in school.
So it may, from an outsider Fox point of view, it may seem crazy that school districts spend money. There was actually another article in the Willamette Week called something like chauffeuring kids, listing the price tag, which is tremendous, of having to do that, of providing transportation for kids who lived in the district but became homeless and ended up someplace else. But can you explain some of the rationale? Why is that so important?
The rationale behind this law has to do with how high mobility gets in the way of education. So research tells us that if a child transfers school twice in a given year, really they do not have that year of education. So, you know, the progressive thinkers behind this law in 1987 really understood that if the child has to change schools too many times, they're not getting an education. And we're really losing out as a society if these kids are not educated.
Mm-hmm. And I think it probably also increases the chance that they just don't go to school at all, mm-hmm. rather than starting over and over and over in a new place where they don't know anybody and everybody looks at them funny because they look funny.
They get really tired of starting over, and I think families get tired of starting over. Some families just give up. There are too many barriers for them.
And included in these educational rights are kids who are in non-permanent foster care. Do you want to say a little bit about that?
That's really kind of a gray area with this law. The law states that children are homeless if they're awaiting foster care placement. And really, if you think of the nature of the foster care system, their lives are really pretty much impermanent all the time. So on a case-by-case basis, we decide if a foster child is homeless. If they have been permanently with that foster family for years and there's a plan to adopt them, then we probably would not consider them homeless because that would be a stable, permanent home. But many times, they're not.
So when Fox talks about these huge benefits somebody gets out of making up these numbers, the benefits really are only some assistance for transportation and a free school lunch.
Yes. Yes. There's no luxury car going to them.
Not for you even.
No, not even for me. The benefit is really to stay at their school, and that's something that kids hold very dear, and we really can't underestimate how important that is for them to stay stable with their friends, with their teachers, with the people who know and care about them.
Mm-hmm. And there's a million and one reasons why a family may become homeless. But very often it involves a fair amount of chaos and other issues that play into the whole situation. And I think sometimes the school is probably the only safe and stable place in those kids' life. So I often wish, you know, before people judge easily something based on numbers, they knew some of the stories.
Yes. And actually, you know, if you look at the numbers, our numbers are probably low. Just speaking in our school district, the numbers we count are just the kids we know about. There's so many that we don't know about. Mm-hmm. There are hundreds more that mm-hmm. we don't know about, that their situation would, in fact, technically qualify them as homeless.
But because of the stigma, people don't necessarily self-identify.
Right. And it's really sad, the stigma, because and the school I work with most closely, we have kids who frequently hide their address. We actually don't know where they're living because they think if they really reveal where they're living, they're going to be kicked out of the school and told to go to a different school. And they don't realize that actually they do have this protection that can keep them in the school. And it's really something that kids hide and families hide for years.
Mm-hmm. I also find that people are very confused about what a homeless kid looks like and where they are. Somehow it's assumed they wouldn't really be in a school. And I think the population you work with, it's two different scenarios. One is children who are with their family, but there also are minors, especially in high schools, who are on their own. You want to say a little bit about these young people who are on their own, like what typically gets them in the situation and how does this law help them?
There are so many reasons kids become unaccompanied, and we even have middle schoolers who really do not have a permanent caretaker in their lives. Families can be ripped apart because of domestic violence, of extreme poverty. Sometimes kids, for being coming out as gay or lesbian, are also kicked out of their home. There are a myriad different reasons. Also, substance abuse by the families really gets in the way of parenting. Many, many ways that kids end up, as we call it, couch surfing for long periods of time.
Mm-hmm.
We have teachers that take them in. We have custodians, nurses. They live in a variety of different places, usually for pretty short amounts of time each time. And again, Gabby, as you said, the one permanent factor is school. So if they can be kept in school, provided a bus pass to get there, a free and reduced lunch, chances are they're going to stay there and actually graduate.
Mm-hmm. And also somebody who knows their situation, that they're not likely to advertise with their peers, and, you know, and cares about them and helps them along if they're having a bad day. I think that's very important, too.
Right. And, you know, you say that homeless kids, you know, many people don't know what they look like, and that's really kind of the beauty of it, that we can keep protect their confidentiality and help them along in the educational system without really announcing to everyone that look, I've got a homeless kid here.
Mm-hmm.
We have 546 homeless kids that we counted in our school district last year, and even people in the schools are astounded. You know, they want to know where they are, and they're sitting in their classes all the time,
mm-hmm.
and they don't look any different.
Do you see an increase in numbers?
We had an increase of about 200 kids from the year before.
From the last school year.
That's pretty significant.
Yeah.
Because of the economic recession right now, many people are losing their jobs.
And I believe that's a national trend, that people who do your job across the country all see a pretty high increase.
Correct. There are more foreclosures and more kids who were kind of traditionally middle class who are now falling into the homeless category.
And the foreclosures doesn't just affect families who used to own a home, but also people who rented a home that then ends up being foreclosed and they're forced to move out.
Right. That causes chaos when the landlord gets the notice that he's being foreclosed, and then he tells the tenants, and they may not be able to afford a housing anywhere mm-hmm. near in the area.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a sense what else is going on nationally? There is a national network of people who do your job, and there's communication. Actually, in a little while, I can announce some websites for people who are interested. What is the national trend in terms of homelessness and homeless children and families in schools?
Actually, those of us in this job are really hoping that the new administration, as they've said, are going to provide more monies to the states that will be then given out to the school districts to provide more help for kids in these situations. This really is an unfunded mandate, as it has been written. With no money attached to it, it doesn't motivate school districts to really help kids when there's no money, and the money has to come out of the general fund.
It's all the Fox News millions.
Yes, exactly. It's the faux news, yes.
Yeah. And I believe there's other resources that are more secondary that are attached to the stimulus package. For example, there will be money for summer youth employment, which a lot of... I should disclose that I do the same job in Vancouver when I'm not volunteering for KBOO. We have the similar job. So there will be funds to hire young people during the summer, which is particularly important for kids who whose families are struggling financially. And there may be similar money coming to assist young people.
That also provides an opportunity for kids to earn money when they're not in school, which mm-hmm. is very much a stress when they have to earn an income and also take a full load of credit.
Mm-hmm. And I got to say, I meet a lot of these kids who are really fully self-supportive financially, which is, to me, mind-boggling. High school students who work exploitive, low-wage jobs in the fast food industry, but they manage to stay in school. They're committed to staying in school. I have kids who will graduate this year, who will go on to college, which is another thing McKinney-Vento can sort of assist with to make that transition. So to judge the fact that they get a free lunch and a bus pass is just outrageous to me, because they work incredibly hard for everything.
Yes, and let's look at the goal. The goal is to give them an education, and that happens with a little bit of outreach and a little bit of advocacy.
We also talked a little bit before the program about the fact that these kids and these families include everybody. You really cannot, I think, generalize who is more likely to be in that situation or not. So it includes everybody, including immigrants and including some immigrant kids who are undocumented.
Yes.
You want to say something about their particular added difficulties?
Lots of added difficulties for them. I should point out also that, you know, in this whole immigration debate or debacle, is however you want to look at it, most of the kids here are born here, actually. And when we don't, you know, provide opportunities for them and their families to have some kind of legal status, it really, really takes away their opportunities to further their education and to have a good life. So lots and lots of barriers for the families.
And some kids who were not born here, they came when they were like 6 months old and have never been back to where they came from. They don't even speak the language anymore, but they are excluded from everything, from having a chance to work to having a chance to go to college.
Right.
And then we complain about criminal, you know, elements, but what do you do if you really have no other possibility?
Right. They're excluded from a lot of the college scholarships. And then when they face the prospect of not having a job after college either, and, you know, even if they get a scholarship to go to college. And we talk to them about the American dream, living the American dream, and they just need to be motivated and succeed. And when there's no possibility that this is going to happen for them, it's really just empty rhetoric and does contribute to a lot of disappointment and dissatisfaction and anguish and dissatisfaction with the system.
And on that topic, the DREAM Act was reintroduced yesterday in Congress. The DREAM Act was voted down once under the Bush administration, and the DREAM Act stipulates that children and young people in that situation could apply for an amnesty. It's very limited who could and how many would get it, but it would be one possibility of opening a door for many of these young people who are here. Like it or not, they're here, they're very motivated, they want to be in school, they want to work. So if our listeners, if you're interested, look up the DREAM Act. There's petitions you can sign, and you can call your congresspeople about supporting
that. These kids are Americans. They're they're assimilated. They've been through the educational system here. To put them back into the country that they came from would be abusive.
So if you tuned in a little late, I'm talking with Molly Fry, who is the homeless liaison in the Reynolds School District, which is in East County, east of the river here in the greater Portland area. And we also talked a little bit earlier about how the East County is neglected. Like, we don't necessarily look what's happening there. What is your assessment, what's going on in terms of poverty and needs in East County, East Multnomah County?
We have some of the most extreme poverty in the state in East Multnomah County. In fact, one of our schools, Alder Elementary, is actually the second most low-income school in the state, the first being the schools of the Warm Springs Reservation. Mm-hmm. Their free and reduced lunch statistic is 95%. So it's extreme poverty. Most of the families there have to rely on other relatives to live with. They live in crowded conditions. And traditionally, although this is changing, I have to say, Multnomah County has neglected the residents of East County.
So what is there in terms of resources like shelters or social services?
We have in our, well, I should say it's in David Douglas District, actually. It's the Daybreak Shelter. It's run by Human Solutions, and that's for families. They have capacity for about four families at the moment, and the waiting list is about a month. And also there's in Gresham, there's My Father's Place. Again, just having a few beds or rooms available for families to live in. Our capacity for housing families is really, really limited.
So really, many families do not have a choice then to find somebody who lets them stay for however little time in whatever little discomfort.
Yes. And for the first time this year, we had actually children who were living in cars. As a result of the recession, both parents losing their jobs and mm-hmm. needing for a period of time to live in their car and move the car around to different neighbors who would actually tolerate them being in their driveway for a certain period of time.
So if somebody wanted to help or wanted more information, where could they get that?
They can get it from the Oregon Department of Education website, and we have a wonderful state homeless education coordinator. Her name is Donna Bolt, and she's always willing to answer questions. And there's a great national website. It's called NCHE, National Center for Homeless Education. They have lots and lots of publications on homeless education, and they have links to each state. And if anyone knows of anyone who's a homeless student, has relatives where they're going to become homeless, needing to move in with another relative, then each school district has to have someone in this capacity as a homeless liaison.
And sometimes even school staff may not know that or may not be very
yes.
volunteering with the
yes.
information. So people
yes.
have to really insist on
yes.
talking to the homeless liaison.
Right. Sometimes registering kids for school can be a really unfriendly process. And we do a lot of advocacy with parents to say, look, this is what you say. I qualify for the McKinney-Vento Act for my rights under that. And they really need to take it sometimes to the top to really get their students registered, which is something we always, as homeless liaisons, we're bound to try and correct. We give trainings all the time and talk about it all the time. But there's only one of us in each school district.
Right. So this is another aspect of your job, is actually advocating and training coworkers.
That's correct. And in fact, part of the law is that each school has to have this kind of a training every year. So I'm talking to people a lot.
And I will announce in a minute, I will announce some of these websites if people want more information and want, we just want to see what people's rights are. And again, being homeless, as in McKinney-Vento definition, does not mean being on the street or being in a shelter only. It could mean being doubled up with somebody else or living in conditions that just aren't fit and that aren't permanent, or being in non-permanent foster care. Is there other things you'd like to share with us about what you do in your job?
Well, I have a couple of success stories. We have kids who go to great lengths to stay in our schools way out in East County. Some kids actually ride the bus every day from North Portland. They have a bus pass, and they get there every day ridiculously on time, which I couldn't. They get up at 5 o'clock in the morning to get to school. And they're being very successful. And this law really, really helped them stay in one place because their family is in a domestic violence situation, and they've been moving a lot. But this law helps them stay in one school, and I believe they're going to be successful.
And like I said earlier, part of our job is to help some of these young people move on to college. We can help them with the application for the financial aid and all that kind of stuff. And they do move on to college. And I'm proud to say that some of the kids I have come across with, they go to college clearly with a mission of being more than just about themselves, but becoming advocates for others and becoming activists, really, for social change. So,
yes.
You know, they're,
yes.
If with a little help to make that possible, many of these young people become very successful and become contributing members of society.
And sometimes they're the ones that know best what the situation is like, and sometimes they bring other students they found out are homeless mm-hmm. to me and say, you know, help them. This is my friend. He wants to stay here in school.
And if you're interested in the topic, and even if you'd like to volunteer, like I had folks volunteer, actually employees, I may as well just say, the employees of the city of Vancouver did monthly drives for me where they collected money, but also clothing and food and school supplies that I was then able to pass on to homeless kids. So if anybody is interested in something like that, call the station and we'll hook you up happily.
Awesome.
And I don't know if you want to give out your number. I don't, but we can go do it through the station.
My number is 503-665-8166.
And again, this is Molly Molly Fry from the Randall School District. She's the homeless liaison there. And the websites, if you are interested in more information, there is the National Center for Homeless Education. And their website is www.serve.org-nche. Another organization is the National Law Center for Homelessness and Poverty. And their website is www.nlchp.org. And then finally, there's the National Association for the Education of Homeless Children and Youth. And their website is www.naehcy.org. And they all have plenty of links. They all have information about the details of the McKinney-Vento Law, what people's rights are. And it's just a good thing to know. Any parting words?
No, thank you for bringing this to everyone's attention.
Thank you very much. I know you are incredibly busy, so thank you very much, Molly Fry from Reynolds School District, for coming out on a Friday night, a cold Friday night, to talk to us.
Thank you, Gabby.
Listening to Bread and Roses, our weekly women's news and public affairs program on KBOO 90.7 FM. And the music we are going out with is music by Al-Andalus, which is playing tomorrow night at Reed College at 7:30 at the auditorium at Reed. And if you're interested in that concert, you can find information again on the web under www.andalus.com. And Andalus is spelled just with you. Thank you for listening to the show. Thank you for Brooke, my engineer, and Molly, my guest. Good evening to you all.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio. This is the community calendar for Friday, March 27th, the 86th day of 2009. Nautical twilight starts at 5:55 a.m. Pacific Daylight Time, with civil twilight at 6:30. Sunrise is at 7 with the midday transit at 1:16 p.m. Sunset occurs at 7:33 p.m. Civil twilight ends at 8:03, with nautical twilight complete at 8:38 p.m. The waxing crescent pink moon rises at 7:03 a.m., transits at 2:05 p.m., setting at 9:21. The first quarter is at 7:34 a.m. Thursday. Boonat Bombs provides free vegetarian food to everyday people in response to artificially created socioeconomic conditions that facilitate poverty, war, and societal distress. Meals are served at 5:30 p.m., Fridays in Colonel Summers Park at Southeast 17th and Taylor. Saturdays and Sundays are under the west end of the Morrison Bridge. For more information, go to foodnotbombs.net or email pdxfnb@lists.riseup.net. It's the last Friday of March. It's time for Critical Mass. 5:30, meet under the west end of the Burnside Bridge. The ride is on at 6. You're invited to celebrate Red Cross Month at an open house event at the Portland Red Cross Blood Donor Center on Saturday from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at 3131 North Vancouver Avenue. You can learn about the Red Cross in your community, training and life-saving skills, and you can also give blood. For more information, go to nwblood.redcross.org or call 503-284-1234. This is Randall with the Friday Calendar. Thank you for listening to and supporting KBOO Community Radio, radio of the people, by the people, and for the people of Cascadia. Happy trails, everyone.